perhaps one of the best known passages of all, one of the parables Jesus taught. It's in Luke's Gospel, and it's in chapter 10, and it's the parable of the Good Samaritan, and we start at verse 25. Luke chapter 10, verse 25. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, What is written in the law? How do you read? And he answered, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Jesus said to him, You have answered right. Do this, and you will live. Now, if it were as simple as that, wouldn't it be delightful? It's all you've got to do. If you want to live forever, and you want real life, that's all. Just love God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. Simple. Or is it? Lawyers like to have it a little more defined than that, and lawyers want to know exactly what words mean, and they're always arguing over the meaning of words. And it's interesting that he seems to have had no difficulty with loving the Lord with all his heart and mind and soul and strength, presumably, because he didn't ask about that one. But he said, well, now let's just have a definition of neighbor, because that could mean anybody. You tell me who I've got to love. And he, desiring to justify himself. Now notice that phrase, terribly important. It means to put himself in the clear, to put himself in the right, to get on the right side of the law. He, desiring to get himself in the clear, said, Who is my neighbor? Who am I supposed to love like myself? And Jesus replied, A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and left him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii, that would be 2 days' wages, and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. Which of these 3 do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, The one who showed mercy on him. And Jesus said to him, Go and do likewise. In other words, if you ask the question, Who is my neighbor? The answer is, You are. Do you understand? Instead of saying it's that person and that person and that person, it's you who are to be the neighbor. In other words, whoever you meet, wherever you meet them, whatever their need, you are the neighbor, not them. You are the one to come in and help. And that's a very profound lesson. When you stop thinking of others as your neighbor and think of yourself as their neighbor. Paul, writing to the Galatians, chapter 6 and verse 10, says this, So then, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. As we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially those who are of the household of faith. There are 2 very hard lessons to learn in connection with Christianity. 1, that you cannot be saved by good deeds. 2, that you are saved for good deeds. And these really are so hard to learn. Both of them go right against human nature. Take the first. There is the complication that Christians do not have a monopoly of good deeds. Let me be utterly honest and say straight away that I meet plenty of people right outside the church who wouldn't even call themselves Christians, who do a great amount of good in the world. And one of the subtle temptations is to think that therefore there is no need for such people to be saved. Or one of the other subtle temptations that comes to you if you're doing the good deeds is that provided you are being helpful and kind to your fellow men, then you don't need to be saved, because in fact you have saved yourself. Now, it really is so difficult for us to learn that it is not the good we have achieved, but the good we have failed to achieve that is decisive in God's sight. You'll realize this as soon as you ask the question, what is the pass mark for goodness? What should it be? 50%? 60%? What do you think would be fair? And would it be fair for a 61% to pass and a 59% to fail? And where are you going to draw the line? The answer is that what God expects of us is greater than anything we expect of each other. And if we expect little of each other and then credit each other when we do good, and credit ourselves when we do, then we're just not thinking like God at all. God expects everything of us. In other words, when I do a good deed, it's not to my credit, it is repaying my debit. I owe it. It's not something I'm doing as a favor. It's something I ought to do and must do because God expects it of me. And it's a revolution in your thinking when you stop coming to God and saying, what a good boy am I, how much I've done, but how much I have fallen short of what God had every right to expect of me. Now, other people may say, he's a grand chap, he's always helping people, he's always doing good. But God says, you are, when you've done your best, an unprofitable servant to me. I've done more for you than I ever got back. I have still not had from you all that I expected and should have had. And I know from my own life, when I look back over its 40-odd years and think how many things I might have done, how much good I might have achieved, and realize I've fallen far short of God's glory. Far, far short. You then realize that you become a Christian not by the good things you have done, but by the good things you haven't. And by the good things that God has done for you. There's a world of difference between saying, I am good enough for him, and saying, he is good enough for me. That's completely different. So that though I'm preaching on doing good tonight, I wanted to begin by saying that you'll never, never get to heaven by doing good, because it would never, never be good enough. It sounds simple to say all you need do is love everybody else as much as you love yourself. But if I said hands up those who do, even with a sober estimate of yourself, would you dare to raise a hand? It sounds so simple to say love God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength, until you begin to look into your divided heart that wants to do good one minute and wants to do something else the next. And so we can never, never be saved by good deeds. And then you discover to your delight that God says, my goodness is enough for both of us. The kingdom of heaven opens wide to beggars, but not to those who come under their own steam. Why? Lest any man should boast. The one thing God cannot stand, which is the root of all other sins, is pride, the big I, the self. And if I can get to heaven by good deeds, then I've done it. I can boast. I can say, well, he may need forgiveness, he may need the blood of Christ, but I didn't. I'm a good chap. I got here under my own steam. I'm a self-made man, I am, and we can stick our thumbs in our lapels and say to God, I'm here because I worked hard for it. Not of works, lest any man should boast. The way that you come into the kingdom of heaven is a way that cuts out all your pride, because you've got nothing to bring. Now, having said all that, the temptation when you've accepted that and become a Christian on the ground of God's goodness and not yours, The temptation then is to say, well, now I can sit back and I don't need to do anything good now. I'm on my way to glory. Heaven is mine. It's not by good deeds, so who cares? Let's enjoy Christianity. Let's sit on the premises. Maybe not stand on the promises, but let's just be there. And let's just enjoy being a Christian. Now, that's the subtle temptation. You see, on the one hand, we've got to resist the idea that we are saved by good works. But on the other hand, when we've been saved by the free grace of God, we've got to remember that God saved us for good works. And the difference is total. The one person will do good deeds in order to get to heaven, and the other will do good deeds because he's going there. And it's the difference between chalk and cheese, those two approaches to doing good. You see, when I'm taken to heaven, when I'm saved, when I become a Christian, I've become a follower of the Lord Jesus. And we're told in the Bible that the Lord Jesus was a do-gooder. He went about doing good. Don't ever allow the word do-gooder to become an insult. It's a great compliment that a person is a do-gooder. That's what we're called to be. And the Lord himself said, I will tell you how I think of social grading. At the top of society are the servants. And at the bottom are those who are waited on. That was his thinking. Those who do good to others are right at the top. The servants. I didn't come to be ministered to, he said. I came to minister. I didn't come to earth to have people do things for me. I came to do things for them. And on the last night in which he was betrayed, he not only took bread, he not only took wine, he took a towel. And he hung it around his waist and he knelt down and he scrubbed feet. That's a menial task in this country, but in the climate of the Middle East, that really is a task. And it was reserved for the lowest slave of all. Even the upper slaves wouldn't wash feet. But Jesus said, this is what I've come to do. You call me Lord and Master at the top, yes, you're right. But I am also your servant. And that's the way it's got to be. And in teaching after teaching, he laid on us the simple duty of doing good and of doing what the Good Samaritan did. In other words, we are saved to serve. Now, I've already said that people outside the church do a lot of good deeds. I thank God that he's not left human beings without a trace of compassion for one another. Otherwise, this world would really be hell. And one day it will be like that. But it's not hell yet, because even atheists and agnostics who don't know God and don't acknowledge him are capable of doing good to their fellow men. Thank God for that. I've been ministered to by people who don't know God, and I thank God for it. But is there a difference between the service that a Christian renders and the service that anyone else does? They may both go and scrub someone's floor. They may both go and dig someone's garden. But is there a difference? There are three profound differences. Number one, motive. Why do they do it? You could do it, of course, to please yourself, for your own sake. A lot of people do good for that. One dear lady said to me, well, whenever one of my neighbors is in trouble, I'm first in to help him, because you never know when you'll need help yourself. Now, she was absolutely honest. She was betraying her motive. It was real, and it was a kind of mutual insurance. And many people do good for precisely that reason. For you never know when you may need help yourself. So pay up the insurance, and then when the tragedy comes, you'll be helped. There are others who do it to please others. Not to help themselves at some future date, but genuinely to help their fellow men. I take my hat off to every humanist who is sufficiently altruistic in his motives to want to help men simply because they're men. But shall I tell you why a Christian does it? To please the Lord. And to please the Lord is a deeper motive than to help someone else or to provide for your own needs. A Christian and an unbeliever may both do exactly the same good deed, and one's doing it to please the Lord, the other's doing it to help men, and there's a difference of motive. Now the second difference. is a difference in the direction in which the goodness goes. Now, a Christian will help anybody, or I hope he will. He should. He's told to do good to all men. But in every Christian's mind, there is always an especially. Especially those who are of the household of faith, the people of God. And while the circle of his help will be as wide as the world, there is a special circle within that for the people of God. And that will be a difference. The unbeliever doesn't have a special concern for God's children. And the third difference will be in the scope of the help. Now, this comes out so clearly at a funeral. I have gone back sometimes after a funeral to a home for the tea, and when you get a mixture of people there, some of whom are Christians and some of whom are not, it's quite striking to see the difference of the scope of the help that can be offered. After muttering the usual clichés, the unbeliever invariably seizes the opportunity to give some practical help and get the tea ready and run around and do things. The believer is able to help at a very deep level, where all the trite clichés of humanism have nothing to offer. The believer is able to say something much more. Why? Because a believer can help a man's soul. Not just his body and his mind, but his soul. When you look at those people in need, do you just see bodies? We're accustomed now to these horrifying photographs of little children, skin and bones, wandering the face of the earth. You've seen these on your telly and in the magazines and newspaper advertisements. But when you look at them, your heart immediately says, oh, if one could help their body. But you know, when a Christian looks at those, a Christian thinks there's a little child being rushed into eternity. Child that has a soul, as well as a body. Who's going to do something about that? In other words, the breadth of your help is going to be much, much deeper. You not only help the body and the mind, the Christian wants to help the soul. Archbishop William Temple was a great Christian, and he wrote a very fine devotional commentary on John's Gospel. And as he worked through it day by day, he would write his own notes about what he'd read. And he came to this phrase in chapter 1. It's the phrase where a brother brings his brother to Jesus. And it says this, and he brought him to Jesus. And Archbishop William Temple wrote this in the margin, the greatest service that one man can ever render to another. What's the greatest service you can render to someone? To lead them to Jesus. Nothing bigger you can do than that, and that's a thing the atheist can't do, it's a thing the agnostic can't do, the unbeliever can't begin to help his fellow men to find forgiveness. But the believer can. Now let's look at our text, and I've got 2 points for my sermon tonight. That must be a record. But here's point number one, do good to all men, and point number two, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So let's look at these two. Do good to all men. No qualifications, no limits of age, race, class, color. No limits. And that's where the Christian must draw his circle. And he must be ready and willing, as he has opportunity, to help anybody. That's a terrific challenge. Now, I'm going to mention 3 channels. I'm getting more points already, but 3 channels of help to all men. And a Christian must, I think, be engaged or involved in all 3. Number 1, personal help. One person helping another. And this is why I read that lovely story of the Good Samaritan. The man said, you tell me who my neighbor is and I'll love him. If you tell me that it's 2 neighbors this way and 2 neighbors that way and 4 over the road, I know where I am. I can begin to love my neighbor. But Jesus turned it right around and he said, you are the neighbor. And anybody you meet, you are called to be a neighbor to them. Your neighbor is not the man living next door. He may be a foreigner. He may be a Samaritan. He may be a Jew. Maybe anybody. But you are to be a neighbor to them. One of the most challenging things I ever heard was about a student in Glasgow in a theological training college. And during his training, he would vanish every other afternoon, or no, it was twice a week, I think, something like Tuesdays and Fridays, afternoons. He would vanish from the college for about 2 hours, and then he'd come back. And the students tried to find out where he went. All sorts of rumors flew around. The main one was that he'd got a fiancée, and the college principal didn't approve of students getting engaged, and so they thought he was meeting her on the quiet somewhere in Glasgow. But the rumors flew round, until finally the students got so curious they decided to follow him without his knowledge, and they followed this student by name of Evans, and they went along this street and along that and down the other. He came to one of those tall blocks you see in Glasgow. They're rapidly disappearing, fortunately, but you know the old blocks I mean. And he climbed the stairs, and he used to go into a little flat there to an old lady, bedridden. And he would spend 2 hours scrubbing the flat, cooking her meals, and leaving everything ready. Then he just slipped back to his theology. Something about that that's Christ-like. He didn't want anybody to know. He wouldn't tell them. He was doing it simply to please the Lord. There was a need that he'd heard about, and he went and did it. Personal help. Only in the day when all things are revealed will the amount of personal help like that be revealed. It was one of my lovely experiences in life when I was ordained to the ministry to have that man's hands on my head. He's now in his 80s, and he's still doing this kind of thing. Wonderful men. Now, Christians have no monopoly on this, I know, but we are to have this at least, whoever else has it. And if I may say, in a place like Guildford, the needs that are crying aloud to be met are not necessarily physical needs. In this sophisticated community, in this affluent society, some of the greatest needs of our fellow men and women are mental and emotional. Loneliness is rife in this place. People who are lonely, often because of their own fault, their own shyness, their own withdrawal, their own inhibitions, their own feelings about what others think, but there's a desperate need. And it's the sort of work that is demanding and exhausting, but it's there to be done. There are individuals in Guildford who may not need their floor scrubbing or their garden digging, though there are those who need that. But there are others who simply need someone to talk to, someone to take an interest, a home that they could drop in, personal help. The second channel that I want to mention is the channel of social services. Now, even in this welfare state, there are many gaps still left, and these are filled by many voluntary agencies. I don't think the church is at all helpful when it tries to duplicate all the social services. I would much rather have Christians injected into those services, bringing God's love, that extra dimension, into the social services. I meet regularly, and I met this Thursday morning, or Wednesday, was it? No, Thursday. Meet regularly with all the social workers of Guildford. There are 50 or 60 in this town. 90% of those one meets are paid full-time. But they have an army of volunteers ranging from Samaritans through Red Cross, WVS, and John's Ambulance, the lot. And it strikes me very forcibly when I meet those, there is a higher percentage of Christians in the social services than perhaps in most other areas of life. It's very interesting to go to a social workers' meeting and meet Christians. And I thank God for Christians who will go into the social services and do good. And the third channel, which is much neglected, is the channel of using your daily work to serve your fellow men. One of the things we need to recover desperately in our day is the idea that you can actually serve God when you're at work. Not by using the boss's time to witness to the man at the next desk. You should do that in the coffee break, not in the time the boss has bought from you. But in serving God in your work. Jesus was a carpenter for 18 years. Do you think he wasn't serving his fellow men in the name of his heavenly Father during that time? And we've got the idea that Christianity can only be followed in your leisure time, that it's a leisure pursuit. Nothing of the kind. There's only one kind of service in the gospel, and that's full-time service. And when you can regard your daily work as your service to the Lord and work for God instead of working for that boss, that makes a great difference. Now again, the idea has got around that a Christian can only offer his work if he's working for people directly. And there's a craze among young people today to be a social worker. And often those with too many problems of their own to sort out want to be a social worker helping everybody else to get just as muddled. Now this is not necessarily Christian service. You can be a carpenter or a butcher. I remember one day a lad in the RAF who was doing his national service came to see me. Lovely lad, living in Kent now. Face like the sunshine. Dear Christian. And he came to me and he said, you know, I've been praying such a lot about what I should do when I leave national service, leave the RAF. And he said, you know, God has now called me to his service and I know what he wants me to do. And I thought, now what's he going to say? Africa, China? And I said, what has God called you to? He said, to be a plumber. I said, tell me more. Well, he said, all the new developments in plumbing. He said, these plastic tubes save burst pipes. He said, I've been reading all up about it. And he said, God has told me I want you to be a plumber. And he said, I can hardly wait to get back to this plumbing. He'd done a little before he came in. And he said, isn't it great? I'll be putting taps in and putting washers in and mending burst pipes for the Lord. And he was thrilled. And he is a plumber now. He's a plumber for God. He's serving his fellow men. And you know, to have a Christian plumber come in when your carpets are all wet and everything's gone wrong, what a difference that must make. And there he is in Kent. He's a plumber for God. And he's called of God to be a plumber. That's Christian service. And he's as much in full-time service as any missionary. He's just doing a different job. Now that's do good to all men. I'll finish by quoting John Wesley. I'm afraid I'm a great admirer of John Wesley at a human level. And when the early Methodists came to John Wesley and said, will you write out some rules for the Christian life for us, to guide us as to how to live a good Christian life? He said, yes, certainly. And this is what he wrote. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And then he gave them the rules. Well, that would keep you out of mischief, wouldn't it? And it's enough to go on with. Let me just read those words again. They're the words of a man who understood what Christian service is. Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. If you want that afterwards, I'll write it out for you. Now the second point. And especially to those who are of the household of faith. It is wrong to serve others and neglect your own family. And years ago I came across a case of just that, where a member of the family would do anything for anybody else and nothing at home. That's not Christian. And you not only have a physical family, you've got a spiritual family. And it is wrong for a Christian to be so busy helping the world that he never does anything for the church, especially for the household of faith. There's a need in your spiritual family for Christian service. And frankly, this is the way to feel at home in a church. If you don't feel at home in a church, it may well be because you're not serving it. You didn't come, I hope, to be ministered unto, but to minister. And it's awfully easy to choose a church to go to where you can be ministered unto. People tell me this. We're looking for a church in the area. We're going to move here. We're looking for a church where we'll get plenty of food. We're looking for a church where our youngsters will be looked after and where there'll be plenty of youth leaders to do things for them. And so they list. Sometimes my heart sinks a little because they never say, we're looking for a church where we might do something, where we can serve. But we're looking for where we can get. I'm afraid that isn't healthy. I remember going out visiting one afternoon years ago, and this is quite literally so. I went into one house And I was shown into the front room, and the lady of the house took a dust sheet off the main chair, folded it up and said, "Do sit down," which I did very gingerly. She took a dust sheet off the other chair and sat down. It was the parlor, the front parlor, used for funerals and weddings. And I sat there, and we had a very formal conversation. She gave me a very dainty cup of tea, and I was scared stiff I'd break it. And then I went on from that house to another house. And the lady was, you know, up to here in soap suds, and she said, "Come on in." I'm through in the kitchen. And when I got through, she pushed a tea towel into my hand and said, "You can talk to me while we do it." And I will tell you this, I felt very much more at home in the second than the first. I was doing a bit of the housework. I was part of the outfit. I was being treated as a member of the family. If you want really to feel at home in a church, then may I suggest that you ask for a job. That you say, "Give me some service to render. Let me come and maybe have a tea towel." Well, now, what is there to do in a church? I want to deal now with a question that concerns this church, because I'm often asked this question. Isn't it true that the larger the church, the less need you have of workers? And many people have said this to me. We've wondered whether to join, and we feel that there'd be much more to do in a smaller church. So we'll move on. Now, what is the answer to this? There are peculiar problems of a larger church in this matter of Christian service. I wish I had a blackboard, because I'd like to draw a graph, but maybe not all of you are graph-minded, but let me try and draw it. As the number in a church goes up and the congregation gets larger like this, which, by the way, it ought to do, a church that's not growing, I doubt if it is a church, because we're told to grow. And as the graph grows up like that, the need for certain kinds of workers tails off, quite definitely. The need for certain kinds of workers drops in proportion. But the need for other kinds of workers goes up quite sharply. And I'll tell you the difference. The need for those who are good with things falls off. And the need for those who are good with people goes up. Now let me illustrate. Those who deal with things. The jobs to be done with things get larger, but they still need a few people to do them, and so they get bigger and bigger jobs. Do you mind if I use the organist as an illustration? It only needs one organist for a congregation, whether it's 20 or 2,000. Do you see that? And our organist job is to play the organ. That's a thing. And he does it delightfully and helps us through that organ. But you see, it doesn't matter how large the congregation is, we only need one organist per service, I presume, and a deputy now and again. But that's all we need. So that in a smaller church, there's a greater need for organists. Now, this applies to treasurers. The accounts of a large church get more and more burdensome, more and more complicated, but you can't share it out. You still have a church treasurer who handles that. There's a limit to the number of people on the doors. For example, no matter how many come to communion, still one person, and John Gladwell so faithfully and lovingly spends an hour and a half getting this ready behind the scenes. And doing that, though I'm sure he'd be grateful for a little help if you'd like to share that. But you see, the job grows bigger, but it's still just one job. Now, in a larger congregation, the need for people doing things tails off. It's still a limited number who each have, I'm afraid, a bigger and bigger job, and you need to pray for them in the strain. The job of doing the church accounts for a church of 20 members is far, far simpler than a church like this with its complex organization. But then the need for workers with people goes shooting up. And I will tell you why. First, because there are more people. Second, because as you get more people, it becomes more and more easy for the individual to get lost in the crowd. And certainly one person can't possibly notice who's there and who's not, and when somebody is in trouble. Much more difficult. Now, you see, somebody occasionally says to me, "Didn't you see I wasn't there on Sunday?" And I don't know whether to be truthful or kind. And I have to say, "Well, I'm sorry, I just didn't notice." And quite frankly, during hymn singings, I much prefer getting on with a hymn rather than looking around to see who's there. But you can't notice. And therefore the need for people to notice goes up. But there's something even more. A larger congregation attracts people with problems, much more than a smaller one. A person with a real personal problem will go where there's a crowd for two reasons which are in conflict. One, that in a crowd they won't be so conspicuous, but two, that in the crowd they might find, possibly more likely to find, someone who can help them because there are more people there. And so a church that is growing draws more and more people with personal problems that need personal help and attention. And therefore the workers that we need, the service we need, are people who are interested in people. If your task is with things, then a smaller church would benefit more from your presence and contribution. But if your gift is to help people, then the larger church is in desperate need of it. We have, for example, in this church, nearly 80 people called pastoral visitors, and each of them undertakes to look after anything up to 10 members of the church, visit them, watch over them, help them in trouble, go to them in need. And that's the team that we have for the members. But then there are other needs. There are young people and students, people passing through, people with these personal problems coming to us. What a great opportunity to please the Lord and serve Him. We are desperately in need of people who can just give themselves to people, who don't need to wait to be told this is your job, who will just look round and see someone lonely or sad and just say, can I be your friend? Can I help? Come home for tea. We don't live far away. That's the kind of help that's needed. The smaller church is usually short of people to do things. A larger church is usually desperately short of people to help people. But it's Christian service. Now, finally, may I sum up? We live in a world of time and space, and both are factors in Christian service. First of all, as far as space goes, distance from people prevents you helping them. To take a simple illustration, there's my dear old dad up in Newcastle fending for himself. I can't go and see him. If he were within 30 miles, I could slip over maybe once a month or oftener and do it within an afternoon and just help. But distance is preventing me from being of much practical help. And the further you are from people in space, the more difficult it is to help them. May I therefore say that if you commute to church, it is more difficult to serve, very much more difficult. The problem is this. Probably you can receive most by traveling a distance to a church. You could give most by going to the church nearest home. But in fact, you need to give and receive, so that you've got to find a happy medium, a church that's going to help you and feed you, but also a church in which you can give. And by and large, the further you travel to a church, the more you will receive and the less you will give. Space has a bit to do with it. But the biggest factor of all is time. Time. You can't help people if you don't give them time. How can you? And time is one of the shortest commodities in our world. We've all been given 168 hours in the week. I think my maths are right. And we've all got the same amount of time. And yet there are demands upon us. If we commute to London for work, there are a couple of hours of day just spent traveling. And time is one of the shortest things. There are so many things to do, things that we've got to do, and there are so many things we'd like to do. May I say that I think, and I speak personally, and I speak for you perhaps, that one of the most severe temptations to wrong use of time in our day is television. It has brought within our reach so many wholesome things to do, unhealthy things as well, but many wholesome things, interesting things, things that help you to feel I understand the world in which I live. And you look at the Radio Times and you see, why, there's a program about world pollution. What an important subject. And you think, now just a minute, it's a meeting down at the church. Which should I do? And there's no doubt about it that television has swallowed up hours of our time. Now, sooner or later, we've got to say, what does God want me to do with my time? There's a place for relaxation. We all need to unwind the bow and then tauten it again. But what does God want with our time? If I'm going to serve God, then it must be full-time service. And I must ask God how much time to spend on this, how much time to spend on that, how much time to spend on people, just people. And above all, how much time to spend with God. But having said all that, have I presented this as an awful duty, as something hard? Believe me, it's the greatest privilege to serve the Lord. I wouldn't change places with anybody for all the tea in China. To serve the Lord is a great and holy privilege. When Nehemiah was getting the people of God to build the wall of Jerusalem, a wall which has now been recently excavated, and you can go and look at the wall that Nehemiah built, and when I saw those stones, I thought of a text in the book of Nehemiah. They finished the wall in how long? 52 days. Why? The people had a mind to work. They weren't just going to come and sit and listen to Nehemiah preach. They were going to work. They were going to build the city of God, and they got on with it. Each man doing his little job, his building his little part of the wall. And the reward? To hear one day Jesus say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord." What's the biggest joy in life? I'll tell you. One of them is a job well done. A job well done. So that you can look back and say, "That's done properly." Isn't it satisfying? And the Lord, for the joy that was set before him, went through the cross, and he knew he'd done a good job. He said, "It's finished, Lord. I've finished it. It's done properly, well and truly finished." And to get to the end of your life and be able to say, "I've finished the job you gave me to do." When I started preaching, there was a dear old local preacher, a lay preacher up in Newcastle-on-Tyne, and he had received a telegram of congratulation from the king, as he was then, and the telegram boy had come up his garden path and given him the telegram, and he'd opened it on the doorstep, and he'd said to this little boy, this little telegram boy, "Do you know you have carried this morning a message from the king?" And the little boy stood up and he puffed out his chest, and he went marching off down the path. He could hardly wait to get on his bike and dash back to the post office and tell the other telegraph boys, "Do you know, I've taken a telegram for the king." And that dear old man wrote to me immediately afterwards and he said, "David, now you've started preaching, you're bearing a message for the King of Kings." Royal service. Isn't it terrific to be in the royal service, on His Majesty's service? "Well done," will Jesus say one day. "You've been good and faithful. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of the Lord than dwell in the tents of wickedness. I'd rather serve Him than anything." Let's pray. Father, it is a holy privilege to serve You, to serve Your people, to serve Your world. Help us then to do good to all men as we have opportunity, especially those who belong to You. Help us to count it an honor to be at the disposal of others, to toil and not to seek for rest, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to give and not to count the cost, to labor, not to ask for any reward save that of knowing that we do Your will. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.